The large oblong glassite containers were silent and empty. All the waterways of sickbay were shallow to allow open breathing and dry surgery. She swam with long, strong strokes, gripped the corner of one machine to make a turn, and passed through a strip door into the trauma unit. She surfaced, open-mouthed for air, bobbed for a moment, then swam over to a wall of thick leaded glass. Two bandaged dolphins floated in a heavily shielded gravity tank. One occupant, connected to a maze of tubing, had the dull-eyed look of heavy sedation. The other whistled cheerfully as Jillian approached.
"I greet you, life cleaner. Your potions scour my veins, but it's this taste of weightlessness which lifts my spacer's heart. Thank you."
"You're welcome, Hikahi." Jillian treaded water easily, not bothering with the curb and rail near the gravity tank.
"Just don't get too used to the comfort. I'm afraid Makini and I are going to kick you out soon, as penalty for having such an iron constitution."
"As opposed to one of bismuth or cadmium?"
Hikahi spluttered a raspberry-like chuckle. Jillian laughed.
"Indeed. And being healthy will be your tough luck. We'll have you out of here breathing bubbles and standing on your tail for the captain in no time."
Hikahi gave her small neofin a smile.
"You're certain this isn't too risky, turning on this gravity tank? I wouldn't want Satima and me to be responsible for giving the show away."
"Relax, Femme Fin," Jillian shook her head.
"We triple-checked. The leak detection buoys aren't picking up a thing. Enjoy it, and don't worry." "Oh, and I hear the captain may be sending a small team back to your island to examine those pre-sentients you found. I figured you'd be interested. It's a sign he's not worried about galactics in the short term. The space battle may last a long time, and we might be able to hide indefinitely."
"An indefinite stay on Kithrip's not my idea of paradise."
Hikahi opened her mouth in a grin of irony.
"If that's meant as cheery news, please warn me when your message is depressing."
Jillian laughed.
"I will. Now you get some sleep. Shall I turn down the light?"
"Yes, please. And Jillian, thanks for the news. I do think it's very important we do something about the Abos. I hope the expedition is a success. Tell Crydike I'll be back on duty before he can open a can of tuna."
"I will. Pleasant dreams, dear."
Jillian touched the dimmer switch, and the lights gradually faded. Hikahi blinked several times, apparently settling into a seaman's nap. Jillian headed for the outer clinic, where Makini would be dealing with a line of complaining crew fan at sick call. Jillian would show the physician Charlie's isotope profiles, and then go back to her own lab to work for a while longer. Sleep called to her, but she knew it would be a long time coming. In this mood that had come upon her, she felt reluctant. Logic was the blessing and curse of her upbringing. She knew that Tom was where he was supposed to be, out pursuing ways to save them all. He knew it as well. His departure had been hasty and necessary, and there simply hadn't been time to seek her out to say goodbye. Jillian was aware of all these considerations. She repeated them to herself as she swam, but they only seemed to disconnect the larger from the smaller of her problems, and rob of poignant consolation the unattractiveness of her empty bed. Chapter 19. Crydike. "Kanik is a study of relationships," he told his audience. "That part comes from our dolphin heritage. Kanik is also a study of strict comparisons. This second part we learned from our human patrons. Kanik is a synthesis of two worldviews, much as we ourselves are." About 30 neo-dolphins floated across from him, bubbles rising slowly from their blowmouths, intermittent, unconscious sonar clicks their only sound. Since there were no humans present, Krydike did not have to use the crisp consonants and long vowels of standard Anglic, but transcribed onto paper, his words would have pleased any English grammarian. "Consider reflections from the surface of the ocean, where the air meets the water," he suggested to his pupils. "What do the reflections tell us?" He saw puzzled expressions. "Reflections from which side of the water, you wonder? Do I speak of the reflections felt from below the interface, or from above? Moreover, do I mean reflections of sound, or of light?" He turned to one of the attentive dolphins. "Wanasetti, imagine yourself one of our ancestors. Which combination would occur to you?" The engine room tech blinked. "Sound images, Captain. A pre-sentient dolphin would have thought of sound reflections in the water bouncing against the surface from below." The tech sounded tired, but Wanasetti still attended these sessions in a fervent desire for self-improvement. It was for the morale of Fenn, like Wanasetti, that the busy captain made time to continue them. Krydike nodded. "Quite right. Now, what would be the first type of reflection thought of by a human?"
"The image of light from above," the mess chief, Stat, answered promptly.
"Most probably, though we all know that even some of the big ears can eventually learn to hear." There was a general scree of laughter at the harmless little put-down of the patron race. Laughter was a measure of crew morale, and he waited as he might test the mass of a fuel cell by hefting it between his jaws. Krydike noticed for the first time that Takata Jim and Kathod John had swum up to join the group. Krydike quashed a momentary concern. Takata Jim would have signaled if something had come up. He seemed to be here simply to listen. If this was a sign the vice-captain was ending his long, unexplained sulk, Krydike was glad. He had kept Takata Jim aboard instead of sending him out to accompany Orly and the rescue party, because he wanted to keep his exec under scrutiny. He had reluctantly begun to think the time might have come to make changes in the chain of command. He waited for the snickering to die down. "Consider now, how are a human's thoughts about these reflections from the surface of the water similar to our own?" The students assumed expressions of concentration. This would be the next-to-last problem. With so much repair work to oversee, Krydike had been tempted to cancel the sessions altogether. But so many in the crew wanted desperately to learn Kanik. At the beginning of the voyage, almost all the Fen had participated in the lectures, games, and athletic competitions that helped stave off spaceflight ennui. But since the frightening episode at the shallow cluster, when a dozen crew Fen had been lost exploring the terrifying derelict fleet, some had begun to detach themselves from the community of the ship, to associate with their own little groups. Some even began exhibiting a strange atavism, increasing difficulty with Anglic, and the sort of concentrated thought needed by a spacer. Krydike had been forced to juggle schedules to find replacements. He had given Takata Jim the task of finding jobs for the reverted ones. The task seemed to suit the vice-captain. With the aid of Bosun Kathod John, he seemed to have found useful work for even the worst stricken. Krydike carefully listened to the swish of flukes, the uncomfortable gurgling of gill lungs, the rhythm of heartbeats. Takata Jim and Kathod John floated quietly, apparently attentive, but Krydike sensed in each of them an underlying tension. Krydike shivered. There had come a suddenly vivid mental image of the vice-captain's shrewd, sullen eye and the bosun's great sharp teeth. He suppressed it, chiding himself for an overactive imagination. There was no logical reason to fear either of those two. "We are contemplating reflections from an interface between air and water," he hurriedly resumed his lecture. Both humans and dolphins envision a barrier when they consider such a surface. On the other side is a realm that is only faintly apparent until the barrier is crossed. Yet the modern human, with his tools, does not fear the water side as he once did. The neo-Finn, with his tools, can live and work in the air, and look down without discomfort. Consider how your own thoughts stretched out when I asked my original question. The idea of sound reflecting from below came to mind first. Our ancestors would have complacently stopped with that first generalization. But you did not stop there. You did not generalize without considering further alternatives. This is a common hallmark of planning creatures. For us, it is a new thing. The timer on Krydike's harness chimed. He was growing late. Tired as he was, he still had a meeting to attend, and he wanted to stop at the bridge to find out if there had been any word from Orly. How does a cetacean, whose heritage, whose very brain, is built on intuitive thinking, learn to analyze a complex problem, piece by piece? Sometimes the key to an answer is found in the way you formulate the question. I'll leave you all today with an exercise for your idle moments. Try to state the problem of reflections from the surface of water in trinary, in a way that demands not a single answer or a three-level opposition, but a plain listing of the reflections that are possible. He saw several of the Fen frown uncomfortably. The captain smiled reassuringly. I know, it sounds difficult, and I will not ask you to recite today, but just to show you it can be done, accept the echo of this dream. A layer divides sky star, sea star. What comes to us at a narrow angle? The hunt-squeaking, star-catching octopus reflects. The night-calling, star-following tern reflects. The star twinkle in my lover's eye reflects. The sun, soundless, roaring show-off, reflects. Krydike was adequately rewarded by the wide-eyed appreciation of his audience. As he turned to go, he noticed that even Takata Jim was shaking his head slowly, as if considering a thought that had never occurred to him before. After the meeting broke up, Gatha John persisted in his argument. You saw, you heard him, Takata Jim?
I saw and heard, Bosun, and as usual I was impressed. Krydike is a genius. So what is it you wanted to point out to me?
Gatha John clapped his jaw, not the most polite gesture to make before a superior officer. He says nothing about the Galactics, nothing about the siege, nothing at all about plans to get us away from here, or, barring that, to fight. And meanwhile he ignores the growing split amongst the crew. Takata Jim let out a line of bubbles.
A split you have busily been encouraging, Gatha John. No, don't bother protesting innocence. You've been subtle, and I know you've been doing it to build a power base for me, though I look away. But don't be sure Krydike will always be too busy to notice. When he does notice, Gatha John, watch your tail, for I won't have known a thing about your little tricks.
Gatha John blew quiet bubbles, not bothering to reply.
As for Krydike's plans, we'll see. We'll see if he's willing to listen to Dr. Matz and myself, or if he persists in this dream of carting secrets back to Earth unopened.
Takata Jim saw the giant Stenos was about to interrupt.
Yes, I know you think we should consider a third option, don't you? You'd like to see us head out and take on all the Galactic single-handed, wouldn't you, Gatha John?
The huge dolphin didn't answer, but his eye gleamed back at the vice-captain.
Are you my Boswell, my Seton, my Igor, or my Iago? Takata Jim thought silently at the giant mutant. You serve me now, but in the long run, am I using you, or are you using me?
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 3,